May 31st, 1995, Goderich, Ontario. After leaving her school, 16-year-old Misty Murray fails to return home and is subsequently reported missing. Even though there are numerous eyewitness sightings of Misty in the days following her disappearance, police focus their attention on her adoptive father, Steve Murray. Over 3 months later, Steve is arrested for Misty's murder and is accused of dumping her body in Lake Huron. Since there is virtually no evidence against Steve, he winds up being acquitted when he goes on trial, and Misty continues to remain a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we're going to be returning to our podcast's home country of Canada to cover an unsolved missing persons case involving a teenage girl, the 1995 disappearance of Misty Murray. It's been a while since we've covered a Canadian case on The Trail Went Cold, and I'm sure some of you may have performed a double take when you saw the title of this episode, because as you're probably aware, the disappearance of Maura Murray might be the most famous missing persons case of the modern era. Well, even though it's nowhere near as well known, the disappearance of Misty Murray is pretty unusual in its own right and has a number of twists and turns. After a difficult childhood in which she was given up by her birth mother, Misty was adopted at age 4 by a couple named Steve and Anne Murray. And no, before you ask, this was not the famous Canadian singer Anne Murray. While they had their ups and downs, Misty's relationship with her adoptive parents was generally good, but after she went missing, the local police began to suspect that Steve Murray had killed Misty, and even though her body was never found, he wound up being charged with murder. But the big complication is that there were a number of eyewitnesses who claimed to have seen Misty in the days and weeks after she went missing, so Steve may have had the dubious distinction of going on trial for killing someone who was still alive. The whole investigation and prosecution was considered to be a major farce, and Steve was ultimately found not guilty by the jury, but in spite of all these sightings, Misty was never tracked down. Even though a quarter of a century has passed, we still don't know what happened to Misty, which is why we're delving into this incredibly bizarre case on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Misty Murray. Our story begins in 1995 in Goderich, Ontario, Canada, a town of approximately 7,500 people located on the eastern shore of Lake Huron. Our central figure is 16-year-old Misty Nicole Murray, who currently lives with her adoptive parents, Steve and Anne Murray, who also have two sons. Misty was originally born in Nova Scotia as Jean Marie Oldfield on October 28, 1978, but her early childhood was a turbulent one, as her single biological mother, Darlene Oldfield, moved around a lot due to struggles with poverty and substance abuse issues. In 1980, Darlene decided to give up Misty for adoption, and she was placed in a therapeutic foster home. It would be 3 years before social workers believed that Misty was mentally healthy enough to be adopted out, and she was finally taken in by Steve and Anne 1 month before her 5th birthday. Misty struggled to adapt to her new family, as she exhibited a number of behavioral problems and emotional breakdowns, but the Murrays provided her with a loving, stable environment, and Misty would eventually develop into an outgoing child who did well in school. As she entered her teen years, Misty became more rebellious and her grades slipped, but a major turning point took place during the fall of 1994 when Misty decided she wanted to make contact with her biological mother. By this point, Darlene Oldfield had cleaned up her life and was living in Toronto with her husband and working a steady job. After the Murrays gave Misty their blessing, she finally met Darlene in person. They began to establish a relationship, and Misty would travel from Goderich to Toronto at least once a month to visit her mother. During the first weekend of June of 1995, Misty was planning to accompany Darlene on a trip to Halifax, Nova Scotia, in order to attend a family reunion and meet her biological grandparents for the first time. Misty was also hoping to spend the entire summer living with her mother in Toronto. On the morning of Wednesday, May the 31st, only a few days before her scheduled trip to Halifax, Steve and Anne dropped Misty off at her high school, the Goderich District Collegiate Institute. After a seemingly routine day in which she attended classes and made a visit to the school nurse, Misty attempted to phone Anne at the elementary school where she worked, sometime between 2:30 and 3 p.m. Anne was not available to take her call at the time, and Misty elected not to leave a message, but this would be the last time she ever made an attempt to contact her family. Misty was a member of the Seaforth and District All-Girls Marching Band and had told her parents that she was planning to stay after school to practice with them. However, Misty never returned home that night and failed to resurface. When Anne discovered that no band practice had actually been scheduled, she became concerned enough to contact the Goderich police and officially report Misty missing. At the outset, there was speculation that Misty's rekindled relationship with her biological mother may have compelled her to run away, as she had started signing her name in her school books as Misty Oldfield instead of Misty Murray. But of course, the big issue with this theory is that Misty was bailing on her scheduled weekend trip to Halifax with Darlene. She left behind a suitcase she had already packed for the trip, as well as $200 in spending money, and a number of photographs she was planning to show to Darlene's family. The Goderich police started looking at the case in a different light when they interviewed Steve and Anne Murray a few days after Misty's disappearance. When questioned about their alibi on May the 31st, Steve neglected to tell them he had taken his speedboat out for a spin on Lake Huron at around 7 p.m. that night. Steve would later claim that he had a bad memory and had honestly forgotten he had used his boat. On the morning of June 1st, Steve left on a business trip to Toronto and said he did not even learn that Misty was missing until he returned home at 8:30 p.m. that night. However, this discrepancy was enough to make the Goderich police suspicious, and the investigation would soon be turned over to the Ontario Provincial Police, aka the OPP. 3 months after Misty went missing, a couple told investigators that they had seen Steve and a young female resembling Misty boarding Steve's boat at the Snug Harbor Marina, and they believed this sighting took place on the evening of May 31st. There would also be an additional witness who reported seeing Steve's boat on Lake Huron that night. He said that he initially saw Steve in the company of a young female, but when he saw him again a short time later, Steve was alone. This was enough to convince investigators that Steve had killed Misty and dumped her body into the lake. On September the 15th, Steve was arrested and formally charged with second-degree murder. Well, aside from the fact that Misty's body had not yet been recovered, the biggest issue with this arrest was that there were a lot of reported sightings of Misty after Steve was alleged to have killed her, and many of these sightings were from eyewitnesses who knew Misty personally. The first notable sighting took place on Thursday, June the 1st, the day after Misty went missing, when one of her fellow high school students, Sarah Crawford, claimed to have bumped into her inside a bargain shop in Goderich. According to Sarah, Misty told her that she had been driving with friends in the nearby town of Clinton and that she might see her in school again on Monday. Some of the details Sarah provided about Misty seemed to match her appearance at the time she was last seen. Even though she had 7 piercings in her ears, Misty was not wearing any earrings when she attended school on May the 31st and Sarah corroborated this. That same day, Misty had also been seen wearing a green nylon jacket, which had the crest for the C4th and District All-Girls Marching Band, and Misty's name was stitched into her left sleeve. Sarah claimed that Misty was wearing this exact jacket, though there was one discrepancy, as Misty had been wearing red shorts while attending school, and Sarah said she was wearing jeans. While Sarah reported her encounter with Misty to the police, they never attempted to corroborate Sarah's story by interviewing the employees who were working at the bargain shop that day. Misty's claims about driving to the town of Clinton, located 20 kilometers away from Goderich, seemed to gain more traction when numerous eyewitnesses reported seeing her there that weekend. Three more of Misty's fellow high school students told police that they saw her walking along Highway 8 from Goderich to Clinton on the evening of Friday, June the 2nd. Since Misty had been seen near a bus stop, police believed they might have mistaken her for Misty's best friend, who had caught a bus from Clinton that same day, but the problem is that the friend's bus had already left hours before this sighting took place, and these students accurately described the same green nylon band jacket Misty had been wearing. A fourth student also recalled seeing Misty in Clinton that night, and even said that he honked his horn at her as he drove past. If that wasn't enough, another student who was a member of the marching band claimed she saw Misty at the Clinton Fair on the evening of Saturday, June the 3rd, and once again, she also described the distinct green jacket Misty was wearing. The student said that Misty was hanging around with a group of people she didn't recognize, and she also looked extra hard to make sure it was Misty, because she was under the impression that Misty was traveling to Halifax that weekend. Additional sightings were provided by two employees at the Clinton Fair, who saw a girl matching Misty's description with two other girls that same night. One employee said he distinctly remembered the sighting because one of these girls was so drunk that he wouldn't allow her on the ride he was operating. However, the Goderich police never informed the Murrays about these sightings in Clinton and specifically told them that Misty had not been seen outside of Goderich. They also neglected to share this information with Child Find, the top organization in Canada for locating missing children. There were additional reported sightings of Misty in Goderich with a man named Jeremy Cook. Now, details about this are very vague, and I'm not sure of Jeremy's exact age, but sources describe him as a quote-unquote adult male who was involved in a sexual relationship with Misty. When questioned by police, Jeremy claimed that the last time he saw Misty was when he cashed his welfare check and paid his rent on May the 30th, the day before she went missing. However, bank records show that these transactions actually took place on May the 31st, and two witnesses, including a woman who worked in a shop located below Jeremy's apartment, claimed that they saw Misty in the apartment stairwell on either the 31st or June the 1st. According to her guidance counselor, Misty also had an ex-boyfriend who was very possessive, and she felt threatened by him. In the weeks following the sightings of Misty in Goderich and Clinton, a number of eyewitnesses would report having seen a girl matching her description in London, Ontario, located 100 kilometers southeast of Goderich. Many of these witnesses reported seeing her at the corner of Dundas and Adelaide Streets, which was known for being a location where street children often hung out. Misty was also seen in the company of older people who were known for their associations with drugs and sex work, and she was described as looking strung out. Once again, before Steve was arrested for murder, the police never informed the Murrays about these sightings of Misty. Steve and Anne only learned about them after they were reported in the media, which prompted them to travel to London to perform their own independent investigation. At one point, the Murrays spoke with a local pool hall owner who confirmed having seen Misty, but said that after her disappearance started generating publicity, Misty's pimp helped her move out of the area. After receiving a call at a residence from someone who claimed to have spoken with Misty, Darlene Oldfield also decided to perform her own independent investigation. She spoke to some street people in Toronto who said they interacted with Misty shortly after the time period she was believed to have left London. She was apparently now going by the name Jean Marie, which happened to be Misty's original birth name, but that detail had never been released publicly. Darlene also spoke to some Toronto police detectives who recalled seeing Misty begging on the streets, but they did not realize who she was until they saw her missing poster at a later time, and they were unable to track her down. Steve Murray would go on trial for Misty's murder in May of 1997, but the Crown prosecution would face a major uphill battle since they had no body, no murder weapon, or any real motive for the crime. The police had also performed a thorough search of Steve's speedboat, but were unable to find any physical evidence which suggested that foul play had taken place. The defense's argument was that no murder had even taken place at all, as they presented no less than 97 eyewitness sightings from people who claimed to have seen Misty alive after Steve was alleged to have killed her on May the 31st. 8 of these witnesses would take the stand to testify at the trial, and the defense presented signed affidavits from 11 witnesses, none of whom were ever interviewed by police, who swore they had seen Misty in London in the weeks following her disappearance. The Goderich police were presented as being woefully inexperienced with handling missing persons cases, and before the investigation was turned over to the Ontario Provincial Police, only one officer had been assigned to Misty's case part-time. As a result, most of the sightings of her in London and Toronto were disregarded and never followed up on. The Crown's theory was that Steve had lured Misty to his boat at Snug Harbor Marina by ordering her to clean it. After taking her out onto the water, Steve proceeded to kill Misty and traveled to the center of Lake Huron, where he tied her body to an anchor and dumped her into a section of the lake where the temperatures were so cold and the water so deep that they would have prevented Misty's body from decomposing and floating to the surface. The Crown's case hinged on the testimony of the couple from the Snug Harbor Marina who claimed they saw Steve climb into his boat with a young female at 7 p.m. on May the 31st. However, there was a big hole in their story. Records show that a 600-foot salt ship called the Agawa Canyon had been docked at Snug Harbor Marina on May the 31st, where they loaded and unloaded cargo from the morning until 6:21 p.m. Even though the couple claimed they had been at the marina the entire day, they never even mentioned having seen the Agawa Canyon. Furthermore, the police did not even learn of the Agawa Canyon's existence until 3 days after Steve was charged with murder, and even though they did follow up by interviewing some of the ship's crew, their investigation was very brief. The Crown's third major eyewitness was the man who claimed he had seen Steve boating on Lake Huron in the company of a young female that night before he saw him alone on his boat a short time later. However, this witness had been boating with 3 other relatives when this sighting took place, and they all contradicted his story, maintaining that they only ever saw Steve alone on his boat and did not recall seeing him with a female companion. By contrast, the defense was able to produce a number of witnesses who verified Steve's whereabouts that night. Steve's story was that he took his boat out for a quick ride on Lake Huron at 7 p.m. and returned 20 minutes later. 3 eyewitnesses who knew Steve personally testified that they saw him return to shore at 7:20, and 2 other witnesses confirmed that they helped Steve load his boat onto a trailer 5 minutes later. Steve then said he took the boat to a shop to have it washed and waxed at 8:05, which was also corroborated by eyewitnesses, and he subsequently went to the Parkhouse Tavern, the business he owned and operated at that time. This seemed to blow a hole in the Crown's theory that Steve dumped Misty's body in the center of Lake Huron, as it would have taken him around 2 hours to travel there and back. It seemed unlikely that he would have had enough time to dispose of Misty at that location if he was only on the water for 20 minutes. Steve even took the stand to testify in his own defense, stating, quote, "I did not realize that, starting about a week after Misty disappeared, the true nature of the police activity was to microscopically examine my movements and my statements, looking for some innocent inconsistency, and then claiming that was evidence of guilt," end quote. In the end, the jury found the Crown's case to be so weak that they deliberated for only 45 minutes before they found Steve not guilty of murder. But in spite of Steve's acquittal, the trial took such a devastating emotional and financial toll on the Murrays, as Steve was forced to sell his tavern at a loss in order to finance his legal defense. Following the trial, Steve struggled to find work, and the Murrays wound up going bankrupt and eventually got divorced. The Ontario Provincial Police were not swayed by the verdict at Steve's trial and continued to express their belief that he was responsible for killing Misty. In fact, they continued to perform searches of Lake Huron for Misty using sonar equipment, but they failed to turn up her body or any concrete evidence that she had been the victim of foul play. Anne Murray publicly expressed her outrage that the OPP was performing these searches without even contacting her, and she decided to file a complaint against them about their conduct during the investigation. Even though Anne would receive a response from the OPP, in which they acknowledged that mistakes had been made, they concluded that no professional misconduct ever took place. Anne soon convinced the Ontario Civilian Commission on Police Services, an independent watchdog agency who oversees the police, to perform their own review, and they would arrange for an audit of the original OPP investigation. The results of this audit would be published in May of 2001, and their conclusion was that the investigation had been mishandled due to insufficient staff, poor training, and inadequate supervision. As a result, a letter of apology would be sent to the Murrays. When Steve was charged with Misty's murder, a court order had forbidden him from making any contact with Child Find, so they were unable to perform a thorough investigation into Misty's disappearance until after he was acquitted. In 2001, Child Find received some tips about a young woman who went by the name Mallory Morgan Lane, who had been seen accessing homeless shelters and youth services in Vancouver, British Columbia. She apparently bore a resemblance to the age-enhanced composite sketches which had been released of Misty, and had a similar gap between her upper front teeth. According to those who interacted with her, even though she was often vague about specific details of her background, Mallory did share stories about herself which were similar to Misty's. At one point, Mallory was told she needed to provide a valid identification or be cut off from social welfare benefits, but she refused to do so and would not have her picture taken for a new ID. A worker at a local shelter where Mallory was staying decided to confront her and ask if she was Misty Murray, but Mallory reportedly became hysterical and fled. I do not believe Mallory was ever tracked down, but when Anne was shown a recent photograph of her, she expressed her doubt that Mallory was Misty. After this, Anne decided to bring an end to her efforts to search for Misty and devote more time to her two sons. Even though Steve got divorced from Anne, he remained friends with her and eventually got a new job as a truck driver, where a large missing poster for Misty was affixed to the back of his rig. Steve left Godrich in order to live a private life in a community just outside North Bay, but he tragically passed away in August of 2018 at the age of 68. Since disappearing over 25 years ago, Misty Murray has never officially been confirmed to be dead or alive, so the actual truth about what happened to her remains a mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Okay, I've covered a lot of missing persons cases on this podcast involving young people, where I was very critical of the police investigation, as they would often write off the victim as a runaway without exploring the possibility that they may have been victims of foul play. But in this case, the exact opposite occurred. The police immediately jumped to the foul play theory and ignored compelling evidence that the victim may have legitimately run away. This story is also a direct contradiction to many of my previous episodes, where I frequently stated that eyewitness sightings in missing persons cases are often inaccurate and unreliable. However, Misty Murray's disappearance has a number of eyewitnesses, some of whom she knew personally, who were certain they saw her, after the date she went missing. And those sightings wound up having way more importance than your average missing persons case, since Steve Murray was charged with Misty's murder. I mean, being wrongly accused is bad enough, but being charged with killing someone who may not have even been dead is a completely different level of messed up. As crazy as it may sound, there are documented cases of defendants who went on trial and even wound up being convicted for murdering someone whose body was never found, but they ended up being exonerated when the victim resurfaced, and it turned out they were alive and well the whole time. But most of these cases took place in the 19th or early 20th century, when information did not travel as quickly, and it was much easier for a missing person to stay completely off the radar. It's pretty shocking that something like this could have taken place during the mid-1990s. Yes, people do often go on trial and are convicted of murder without a victim's body, but this generally happens when there's compelling evidence to prove that a homicide took place and the defendant was the perpetrator. Here, the entire case against Steve Murray was, he took a boat out on the lake the same night his daughter went missing and forgot to tell the police. And that's literally all they had. I'm not exaggerating when I say that this might be the weakest case I've ever seen presented against a defendant at a murder trial, and it's mind-blowing that this even made it into a courtroom. Thankfully, good sense did prevail when it took the jury only 45 minutes to find Steve not guilty. And following the trial, one of the jurors actually presented Ann Murray with a note which read, quote, "If they thought 45 minutes was fast, 12 people went to the bathroom and 2 had a smoke break in that time," end quote. It really does seem likely that Steve genuinely forgot to tell the police he had taken his boat out onto Lake Huron because at that point, he was not yet aware that Misty was missing, and he did not even find out until the following evening. That's the thing with innocent people who are falsely accused of crimes. In their minds, it was just a routine, ordinary day in which they did unmemorable things, so when asked to account for their whereabouts on that date at a later time, they may not accurately remember all the details. The only piece of evidence to indicate that Steve might have used this opportunity to commit murder is the eyewitness testimony from the couple who said they saw Steve boarding his boat at the marina with a young female on the evening of May 31st. But the problem is that even though Misty's disappearance was big news in the area, the couple did not actually mention seeing her until they were contacted by police 3 months after she disappeared. I'm not saying they were intentionally lying, but I think there's a good chance that they had seen Steve and Misty boarding the boat on a previous occasion and got mixed up about the date. Steve had numerous witnesses who backed up his story that he was only out on Lake Huron for 20 minutes, and while it's certainly not impossible that he could have dumped a body during that time frame, there's no way he traveled to a section of the lake which was so deep that Misty's body never resurfaced. Even though I grew up in southern Ontario, I surprisingly don't remember hearing about this case too much in the media when it originally happened, though I have actually been through the town of Goderich on a couple of occasions. In fact, the nearby town of Clinton, where Misty would be seen following her disappearance, is the site of one of the most famous crimes in Canadian history, the 1959 murder of 12-year-old Lynn Harper. A 14-year-old friend named Stephen Truscott would be charged and convicted of her murder and sent to the Huron County Jail in Goderich, but he was fully exonerated of the crime decades later. In both that case and the disappearance of Misty Murray, the investigators were heavily criticized for having tunnel vision, and it was obvious that the Goderich police were ill-equipped to handle Misty's disappearance. Once they became convinced that she was murdered by their adoptive father, nothing was going to change their minds, and they deliberately ignored dozens of sightings which seemed to indicate that Misty was still alive somewhere. It's particularly frustrating that the police still refused to change their stance following Steve Murray's acquittal, as they continued to waste a ton of time and resources searching Lake Huron for a non-existent body instead of pursuing other leads. But of course, if Misty was found alive and recovered safely, then it would have been a major PR disaster for the investigators, since this would now prove that they charged an innocent man with a non-existent murder. Even after Steve passed away in 2018, Wally Baker, a retired OPP detective inspector who led the original investigation, stated, quote, "I definitely wouldn't have charged him if I thought he wasn't guilty." Hell, the Ontario Provincial Police website has a missing persons profile page for Misty Murray, which contains this line, quote, "There have been no credible sightings of Misty since May the 31st, 1995. It is very likely that Misty was the victim of foul play on or about that date," end quote. So it's clear that they are just absolutely refusing to change their original murder narrative. And here's another story which will make you even more angry with them. During the week prior to her disappearance, Misty had written a letter to her adoptive parents in which she apologized for being such a difficult daughter at times, thanking them for their love and asking for their forgiveness. It read, quote, "If I were you, a long time ago, I would have given up on me, but I know you love me. Your daughter forever always, Misty Nicole Murray," end quote. Well, after Misty went missing, Anne turned this note over to the police, but they refused to give it back. When she filed a formal complaint against the OPP years later, they told her that if she dropped it, they would be willing to give the note back. It's also worth mentioning that some of the witnesses who claimed to have seen Misty alive following her disappearance would face their own legal trouble. One of them, a 17-year-old girl, testified that in June of 1995, she struck up a conversation with a teenage girl she met at a mall in London who told her that she was a runaway named Misty. The girl then decided to invite the runaway to spend the night with herself and her mother before they went their separate ways. However, in November of 1997, the girl would be charged with obstructing justice and perjury, and after admitting she had lied, she received a sentence of probation. A London couple named Robert and Robin Maness were also charged with obstruction of justice after giving sworn affidavits that they had provided shelter, food, and a shower to Misty in June of 1995. However, when the couple went on trial for this charge in December of 1998, they were both found not guilty. I don't know if this was a case of the OPP going on a witch hunt to destroy their narrative that Misty was dead, but there were so many witnesses who claimed to have seen her in multiple locations. That's not to say that some of them weren't mistaken, but I'm sure they genuinely believed they saw what they saw. It's sad to think that if Misty really was a runaway who was living on the street and had gotten mixed up with drugs and sex work, she might have been rescued if these sightings were properly investigated. It's also interesting how, in contrast to how they treated the Murrays, the investigators were very sympathetic towards Misty's biological mother, Darlene Oldfield, painting her as a mother who had managed to reconnect with her daughter after 14 years, but then had to suffer the trauma of seeing Misty get murdered by her adoptive father. Following Steve's trial, Anne Murray had a very optimistic attitude that Misty would be found alive someday, but during interviews that Darlene gave, she was much more pessimistic about the situation, as she did not believe Misty would have just run off without saying anything to her. Darlene accepted that Misty was likely dead, though she never went so far as to accuse Steve or anyone else of killing her. Investigators may have been attempting to plant the seeds that Steve had become jealous that Misty was reconnecting with her mother and developing a close relationship with her. I suppose that could have given Steve a potential motive for murder, but the problem is that he did not appear to have any known history of violence or abuse, and as you can tell from Misty's final note, it sounds like the Murrays offered nothing but unconditional love towards her, even when she wasn't the easiest child to raise. I think we can safely say that the scenario of Steve killing Misty and dumping her into Lake Huron is nonsense, but of course that only opens up the question of what did happen to her. Well, even though the sightings of Misty in London and Toronto could have been mistaken identity, since they were reported by strangers, I do put a lot of stock into the sightings of her in Goderich and Clinton, because they were from people who knew Misty personally. One of the most interesting was from Sarah Crawford, a fellow classmate of Misty's, who said she flat out spoke to her in a bargain shop in Goderich on June the 1st, the day after she was last seen. There's no reason to believe Sarah was lying, and while I guess it's possible she could have been mistaken about the date, Sarah did report the sighting the very next day, and it's interesting how Misty apparently said she had been driving with friends in Clinton, the same place she would be seen by several different witnesses over the next few days. And since some of these sightings took place at a weekend fair, which would have been scheduled on specific dates, that makes it unlikely that Misty was seen by people who got mixed up about when they saw her. The fact that so many of these witnesses described her as wearing her distinct green nylon jacket for the C4th and District All Girls Marching Band lends additional credence to these sightings. But here's the big unanswered question. If Misty did decide to run away, Why would she do so on the same weekend she was planning to leave on a trip to Halifax with Darlene? This was when she was going to meet her biological grandparents for the first time, and she seemed so excited for the trip that she had already pre-packed a suitcase. And as you recall, one of Misty's schoolmates who saw her in Clinton said that she had to double-check extra closely to make sure it was her, since she knew Misty was supposed to be in Halifax that weekend. Even if Misty was having issues with the Murrays, which made her want to run away from them, it sounded like things were going great with her and Darlene, so why would she just bail on her like that? Well, in September of 1999, the National Post published an extensive article about the case, containing comments from Anne Murray, where she described Misty as having an attachment disorder due to the emotional neglect she experienced during her early childhood. Anne worked as a teacher trained to assist children with learning disabilities, which is one of the reasons she was believed to be a good candidate to adopt Misty, so she knows what she's talking about. Misty weighed only 32 pounds at the time of her adoption, and may have been affected by fetal alcohol spectrum disorder because of her own mother's alcoholism during her pregnancy. Anne described Misty's initial integration into their family as, quote-unquote, hell on earth, as she was tormented by nightmares and uncontrollable sobbing, and Misty would often ask what she had done to make her foster family get rid of her. While it sounds like Misty's reunion with Darlene had been nothing but good for her, you have to wonder if she still had it in the back of her mind that her mother had given her up for adoption when she was an infant, and she feared that she might get abandoned again. Taking a weekend trip to meet her other biological relatives was a big step for her, so maybe Misty just got cold feet and decided to avoid it by running off. During her conversation with Sarah Crawford, Misty said that she might see her again in school on Monday, so maybe this is an indication that Misty was only planning to hide out for the weekend before returning home. During that same National Post interview, Anne stated that children with attachment disorders sometimes have a propensity to form indiscriminate relationships and have zero fear of strangers. When Misty was still a child, she had a tendency to walk up to strangers and start conversations, and even go so far as to ask if she could live with them. So what if Misty crossed paths with a manipulative person who somehow convinced her to run away with them? Most of the sightings of her in London described her as looking like a street girl, and at least one witness claimed that Misty was in the company of a pimp, so perhaps the wrong person lured her into drugs and sex work. We know that the last confirmed sighting of Misty took place on the afternoon of May the 31st, when she attempted to phone Anne from her high school but was unable to reach her, and it's never been determined what the purpose of this call was intended to be. Some of the sources specifically state that Misty visited the school nurse that day for, quote-unquote, reasons not made public. Obviously, I can understand them not disclosing any details for privacy reasons, but you have to wonder if the visit to the nurse might have been what compelled Misty to make that call to Anne or had any influence on her decision to run away. Misty had told her parents she was staying after school for band practice, even though there was no practice scheduled that day, so she probably had something planned which she felt the need to lie about. So this leads us to the big wild card in this story, Jeremy Cook, who was supposedly in a sexual relationship with Misty at the time of her disappearance. While the sources describe Jeremy as an adult male, the age of consent in Ontario for non-exploitive activity is 16, which was Misty's age. But given that details about Jeremy are very limited, I can't say with 100% certainty that he played a non-exploitive role in Misty's life. We know that there was a discrepancy in Jeremy's story that he last saw Misty on May the 30th, even though two witnesses reported seeing her at the location of Jeremy's apartment on May the 31st or June the 1st. If Misty had been planning to go see him after she left school, then you can understand why she would lie to her family about having band practice. I know it's tempting to theorize that perhaps Misty discovered she was pregnant during her visit to the school nurse, and Jeremy was the father, which definitely provides a potential explanation for her going into hiding and missing out on her weekend trip to Halifax. But without knowing anything else about Jeremy's background, this is nothing more than pure speculation. We do know that Misty was apparently seen in the company of multiple people at the Clinton Fair, some of whom were girls, so it's possible she simply stayed at Jeremy's apartment for a day or two before running off, and that's the furthest extent of his involvement in her disappearance. Under normal circumstances, whenever a teenage girl goes missing like this, I would assume she was the victim of an abduction, but the sightings of Misty and Godrich and Clinton are fairly credible, and at no point did any of the witnesses describe her as looking like she was under duress or being held captive. So I guess the big piece of the puzzle that's missing is if Misty was at the Clinton Fair and the street girl seen in London weeks later really was her, how did she get from point A to point B? Well, we have that one pool hall owner who claimed that Misty was with a pimp who helped her move out of London when her case started generating publicity, and this could also account for the subsequent sightings of her in Toronto. If this is true, then Misty may have fell prey to a manipulative person who hooked her on drugs and forced her into sex work. Even though it sounds like the Murrays, as well as Darlene Oldfield, always showed great love and support towards Misty, and would have taken her back in a heartbeat if she tried to return home, she may have gotten in way too deep, and due to her attachment disorder, would not even consider the possibility of trying to get in touch with her guardians again. Even so, if Misty was still alive when Steve went on trial for her murder, you have to wonder if she ever found out about it and what she must have felt. We also have the sightings of the homeless young woman in Vancouver named Mallory Morgan Lane, who was believed to be Misty and supposedly freaked out when someone asked if she was her. I know that Anne looked at a photograph of Mallory and doubted she was Misty, but this was 5 years after she originally went missing. I guess the only way anyone could have been 100% certain is if Mallory was found and given a DNA test. But even if Misty did run away and spent a couple of years living on the streets, what are the odds that she is still alive today? If Misty is alive, she would be 42 years old at the time of this recording, but it's hard to imagine surviving a lifestyle like that for nearly a quarter of a century. I may sound like a broken record, but once again, it is just so infuriating that most of these sightings of Misty in 1995 were completely ignored, because if the police had done their due diligence and not wasted all their time on a fictitious murder scenario, Misty might have been found and returned home safely. I would definitely rank this as one of the most botched police investigations I've ever seen, but the whole case is still a pretty baffling mystery, since it's still unclear what actually happened to Misty. While the odds are definitely slim, there is a chance that Misty might actually be alive somewhere, so if you happen to have any information about her disappearance, please contact ChildFind at 1-800-387-7962. That's 1-800-387-7962. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode which covered two cases from Unsolved Mysteries, involving young women who were supposedly afflicted with amnesia after surviving a violent attack. The stories of Kyra Cook and Sarah Powell. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Lauren M., Maduka M., Abigail C., and Catherine K. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Disturbed True Horror Stories.
Derek's face was stony and etched with rage as he sat in the dark cab staring at my house.
As they described it, the police found his blog where he wrote about his obsession with one of the girls who lived next door.
The most disturbing true tales of terror.
I could kill you right now if I wanted to. No one would ever find you.
Israel Keyes, most known for murdering an underage girl in Alaska, dismembering her body and dropping the pieces into a frozen lake.
Featuring narrations by the best in the business.
She grabbed me by the throat and by my hair and pushed me under the water again.
I can honestly say I have never been so scared in my life.
I'm your host, Chad. Join me every Thursday on Disturbed True Horror Stories in your favorite podcast app or online at disturbedpodcast.com for the most immersive true horror experience.
I'd also like to mention that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London. I had previously stated that CrimeCon UK was set to take place on the weekend of June 12th and the 13th, but due to restrictions, they have now elected to postpone it until the weekend of September the 25th and 26th, so fingers crossed that it will still happen as planned. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLE21. That's COLE21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I hold what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.